Chapter 4. He crossed the border at Columbus, New Mexico. The guard in the gate shack studied him briefly and waved him through, as if he saw his like too often these days to be in doubt about him. Billy halted the horse anyway. "I'm an American," he said, "if I don't look like it." "You look like you might have left some bacon down there," the guard said. "I ain't come back rich, that's for sure." "I guess you come back to sign up." "I reckon, if I can find an outfit that'll have me." "You needn't to worry about that. You ain't got flat feet, have you?"
"Flat feet?"
"Yeah, you got flat feet, they won't take you."
"What the hell are you talking about?"
"Talking about the army."
"Army?"
"Yeah, the army. How long you been gone, anyways?"
"I don't have no idea. I don't even know what month this is."
"You don't know what's happened?"
"No, what's happened?"
"Hellfire, boy, this country's at war."
He took the long, straight clay road north to Deming. The day was cold, and he wore the blanket over his shoulders. The knees were out of his trousers, and his boots were falling apart. The pockets, which had hung by threads from his shirt, he'd long ago torn off and thrown away, and the back of the shirt where it had separated was sewn with agave, and the collar of his jacket had separated, and the shredded facing stood about his neck like some tawdry sort of lace, and gave him the improbable look of a ruined dandy. The few cars that passed gave him all the berth that narrow road afforded, and the people looked back at him through the rolling dust as if he were a thing wholly alien in that landscape. Something from an older time of which they'd only heard, something of which they'd read. He rode all day, and he crossed in the evening through the low foothills of the Florida mountains, and he rode on across the upland plain into the dusk and into the dark. In that dark he passed a file of 5 horsemen riding south back the way he'd come, and he spoke to them in Spanish and wished them a good evening, and they spoke back to him, each one in their soft voices, as they passed, as if the closeness of the dark and the straightness of the way had made of them Confederates, or as if only there would Confederates be found. He rode into Deming at midnight and rode the main street from one end to the other, the horses' shoeless hooves clapping dully on the blacktop in the silence. It was bitter cold. Nothing was open. He spent the night in the bus station at the corner of Spruce and Gold, sleeping on the tile floor wrapped in the filthy serape with his war bag for a pillow and the stained and filthy hat over his face. The sweat-blackened saddle stood against the wall along with the shotgun in its scabbard. He slept with his boots on, and he got up twice in the night and went out to see about his horse, where he'd left it tethered to a lamp standard by the catch rope. In the morning when the cafe opened, he went up to the counter and asked the woman where you went to join the army. She said that the recruiting office was at the armory on South Silver Street, but she didn't think they'd be open this early. "Thank you, ma'am," he said.
"You want some coffee?"
"No, ma'am, I ain't got no money."
"Sit down," she said.
"Yes, ma'am."
He sat on one of the stools, and she brought him a cup of coffee in a white china mug. He thanked her and sat drinking it. After a while, she came from the grill and set a plate of eggs and bacon in front of him and a plate of toast.
"Don't tell nobody where you got it," she said.
The recruiting office was closed when he got there, and he was waiting on the steps with 2 boys from Deming and a 3rd from an outlying ranch when the sergeant arrived and unlocked the door. They stood in front of his desk. He studied them.
"Which one of y'all ain't 18?" he said.
No one answered.
"They's usually about 1 in 4, and I see 4 recruits in front of me."
"I ain't but 17, Billy said.
The sergeant nodded.
"Well," he said, "you'll have to get your mama to sign for you."
"I don't have no mama. She's dead."
"What about your daddy?"
"He's dead, too."
"Well, you'll have to get your next of kin, uncle or whatever. You'll need to get a notarized statement."
"I don't have no next of kin. I just got a brother, and he's younger than me."
"Where do you work at?"
"I don't work nowheres."
The sergeant leaned back in his chair.
"Where are you from?" he said.
"From over towards Cloverdale."
"You got to have some kin."
"Not that I know of, I don't."
The sergeant tapped his pencil on the desk. He looked out the window. He looked at the other boys.
"You all want to join the army?" he said.
They looked at one another.
"Yes, sir," they said.
"You don't sound real sure."
"Yes, sir," they said.
He shook his head and swiveled his chair and rolled a printed form into his typewriter.
"I want to join the cavalry," the boy from the ranch said. My daddy was in the cavalry in the last war.
Well, son, you just tell him when you get to Fort Bliss that that's what you want to do.
Yes, sir. Do I need to take my saddle with me?
You don't need to take a thing in the world. They're going to look after you like your own mother.
Yes, sir.
He took their names and dates of birth and next of kin and their addresses one by one, and he signed 4 meal vouchers and gave them to them, and he gave them directions to the doctor's office where they were to get their physical examinations, and he gave them the forms for that.
You all should be done and back here right after dinner, he said.
What about me? Billy said.
Just wait here. The rest of you all take off now. I'll see you back here this afternoon.
When they'd left, the sergeant handed Billy his forms and his voucher.
You look there at the bottom of that second sheet, he said. That's a parental consent form. If you want to join this man's army, you better bring it back with your mama's signature on it. If she has to come down from heaven to do it, I don't have a problem in the world with that. You understand what I'm telling you?
Yes, sir. I guess you want me to sign my dead mama's name on that piece of paper.
I didn't say that. Did you hear me say that?
No, sir.
Go on, then. I'll see you back here after dinner.
Yes, sir.
He turned and went out. There were people standing in the door behind him, and they stood aside to let him pass.
Parham, the sergeant said.
He turned.
Yes, sir, he said.
You come back here this afternoon now, you hear?
Yes, sir.
You ain't got no place else to go.
He walked across the street and untied his horse and mounted up and rode back up Silver Street and up West Spruce, holding the papers in his hand. All the streets east and west were trees, north and south minerals. He tied his horse in front of the Manhattan Cafe, catty corner from the bus station. Next to it was the Victoria Land and Cattle Company, and 2 men in the narrow-brimmed hats and walking-heel boots that landowners wore were standing on the sidewalk talking. They looked at him when he passed, and he nodded, but they didn't nod back. He slid into the booth and laid the papers on the table and looked at the menu. When the waitress came, he started to order the plate lunch, but she said that lunch didn't start till 11 o'clock. She said he could get breakfast.
I've done it one breakfast today.
Well, we don't have no city ordinance about how many breakfasts you can eat.
How big of a breakfast can I get?
How big of a one can you eat?
I've got a meal ticket from the recruiting office.
I know it. I see it laying yonder.
Can I get 4 eggs?
You just tell me how you want them.
She brought the breakfast on an oblong crockery platter with the 4 eggs over medium and a slice of fried ham and grits with butter, and she brought a plate of biscuits and a small bowl of gravy.
You want anything else, you let me know, she said.
All right.
You want a sweet roll?
Yes, ma'am.
You need some more coffee?
Yes, ma'am.
He looked up at her. She was about 40 years old, and she had black hair and bad teeth. She grinned at him.
I like to see a man eat, she said.
Well, he said, you're looking at one I believe ought to meet your requirements.
When he was done eating, he sat drinking coffee and studying the form his mother was supposed to sign. He sat studying it and thinking about it, and after a while he asked the waitress if she could bring him a fountain pen. She brought it and handed it to him.
Don't carry it off, she said. It ain't mine.
I won't.
She left to go back to the counter, and he bent over the form and wrote on the line Louisa May Parham. His mother's name was Carolyn. When he walked out, the other 3 boys were coming up the sidewalk toward the cafe. They were talking together like they'd all been friends forever. When they saw him, they stopped talking, and he spoke to them and asked them how they were doing, and they said they were doing all right and entered the cafe. The doctor's name was Moyer, and his office was out on West Pine. By the time he got there, there were 6 people waiting, mostly young men and boys, sitting holding their recruiting forms. He gave his name to the nurse at the desk and sat in a chair and waited along with the others. When the nurse finally called his name, he was asleep, and he jerked awake and looked around, and he didn't know where he was.
Parham, she said again.
He stood up.
That's me, he said.
The nurse handed him a form, and he stood in the hallway while she held a card over his eye and told him to read the chart on the wall. He read it to the bottom letter, and she tested the other eye.
You got good eyes, she said.
Yes, ma'am, he said. I always did.
Well, I guess so, she said. You don't normally start out with bad ones, and they get better.
When he went into the doctor's office, the doctor had him sit in a chair, and he looked in his eyes with a flashlight, and he put a cold instrument in his ear and looked in there. He told him to unbutton his shirt.
"You came here horseback," he said.
"Yes, sir."
"Where'd you come from?"
"Mexico."
"I see. Have you got any history of disease in your family?"
"No, sir. They're all dead."
"I see," the doctor said.
He put the cool cone of the stethoscope against the boy's chest and listened. He thumped his chest with the tips of his fingers. He put the stethoscope to his chest again and listened with his eyes closed. He sat up and took the tubes from his ears and leaned back in his chair.
"You've got a heart murmur," he said.
"What does that mean?"
"It means you won't be joining the army."
He worked for a stable out on the highway for 10 days and slept in a stall until he had money for clothes and for the bus fare to El Paso, and he left the horse with the owner of the lot and set out east in a new ducking cloth work coat and a new blue shirt with pearl buttons. It was a cold and blustery day in El Paso. He found the recruiting office, and the clerk filled out the same forms over again, and he stood in line with a number of men, and they undressed and put their clothes in a basket and were given a brass chit with a number on it, and then they stood in line naked holding their papers. When he reached the examining station, he handed the doctor his medical form, and the doctor looked in his mouth and into his ears. Then he put the stethoscope to his chest. He told him to turn around, and he put the stethoscope to his back and listened. Then he listened to his chest again. Then he picked up a stamp from the desk and stamped Billy's form and signed it and picked up the form and handed it to him.
"I can't pass you," he said.
"What's wrong with me?"
"You've got an irregularity in your heartbeat."
"There ain't nothing wrong with my heart."
"Yes, there is."
"Will I die?"
"Sometime. It's probably not all that serious, but it will keep you out of the army."
"You could pass me if you wanted to."
"I could, but I won't. They'd find it somewhere down the line anyway, sooner or later."
It was not yet noon when he walked out and down San Antonio Street. He went down South El Paso Street to the Splendid Cafe and ate the plate lunch and walked back to the bus station, and he was in Deming again before dark. In the morning, when he walked up the barn bay, Mr. Chandler was sorting through tack in the saddle room. He looked up.
"Well," he said, "did you get in the army?"
"No, sir, I didn't. They turned me down."
"Well, I'm sorry to hear it."
"Yes, sir, I am too."
"What do you aim to do?"
"I'm going to try them in Albuquerque."
"Son, they got an awful lot of recruiting offices set up all over the country. A man could make a career out of it."
"I know it. I'm going to try it one more time." He worked on to the end of the week and drew his pay and took the bus out on Sunday morning. He was all day on the road. Night set in just north of Socorro, and the sky was filled with flights of waterfowl circling and dropping into the river marshlands east of the highway. He watched with his face to the cold and darkening glass of the window. He listened for their cries, but he could not hear them above the drone of the bus. He slept at the YMCA, and he was at the recruiting office when they opened in the morning, and he was on the bus south again before noon. He'd asked the doctor if there was any medicine he could take, but the doctor said that there was not. He asked if there was something you could take that would make it run all right for just a while.
"Where are you from?" the doctor said.
"Cloverdale, New Mexico."
"How many different recruiting offices have you tried to enlist at?"
"This makes the third one."
"Son, even if we did have a deaf doctor, we wouldn't put him to listening to recruits with a stethoscope. I think you need to just go on home."
"I don't have one to go to."
"I thought you said you were from Somethingdale. Where was it?"
"Cloverdale."
"Cloverdale."
"I was, but I ain't no more. I don't have any place to go. I think I need to be in the army. If I'm going to die anyways, why not use me? I ain't afraid."
"I wish I could," the doctor said, "but I can't. It's not up to me. I have to follow regulations like everybody else. We turn away good men every day."
"Yes, sir."
"Who told you you were going to die?"
"I don't know. They never told me I wasn't going to."
"Well," the doctor said, "they couldn't very well tell you that, even if you had a heart like a horse, could they?"
"No, sir, I reckon not."
"Go on now."
"Sir?"
"Go on now."
When the bus pulled into the lot behind the bus station at Deming, it was 3 o'clock in the morning. He walked out to Chandler's and went to the saddle room and got his saddle and went to the stall and led Nino out into the bay and threw the saddle blanket over him. It was very cold. The barn was oak batboards, and he could see the horse's breath pass across the slats lit from the single yellow bulb outside. The groom Ruiz came and stood in the door with his blanket around his shoulders. He watched while Billy saddled the horse. He asked him if he had succeeded in joining the army.
No, Billy said.
Lo siento. Yo también.
¿A dónde va?
No sé.
¿Regresa a México?
No. Ruiz nodded.
Buen viaje, he said.
Gracias. He led the horse out down the barn bay and through the door and mounted up and rode out. He rode through the town and took the old road south to Hermanas and Dachita. The horse was newly shod and in good plight from the grain it had been fed on, and he rode the sun up, and he rode all day, and rode it down again, and rode on into the night. He slept on the high plain, wrapped in his blanket, and rose shivering before dawn, and rode on again. He quit the road just west of Achita, and rode through the foothills of the Little Hatchet Mountains, and struck the railroad coming out of the Phelps Dodge Smelter to the south, and crossed the tracks, and reached the shallow salt lake at sunset. There was water standing in the flats as far as he could see, and the sunset on the water had turned it to a lake of blood. He tried to put the horse forward, but the horse could not see across the lake and balked and would not go. He turned and rode south along the flats. Gillespie Mountain lay covered in snow, and beyond that the Animas Peaks, standing in the last of that day's sun with the snow lying red in the rincones. And far to the south the pale and ancient Cordilleras of Mexico, impounding the visible world. He came to the remnants of an old fence and dismounted and twisted out the staples from some of the spindly posts and made a fire and sat with his boots crossed before him, staring into it. The horse stood in the dark at the edge of the fire and gazed bleakly at the barren salt ground. "It's your own doing," the boy said. "I got no sympathy for you." They crossed the flat, shallow lake in the morning, and before noon they struck the old Playas road and followed it west into the mountains. There was snow in the pass and not a track in it. They rode down into the beautiful Animas Valley and took the road south from Animas and reached the Sanders Ranch about 2 hours past nightfall. He called from the gate and the girl came out on the porch.
"It's Billy Parham," he called.
"Who?"
"Billy Parham." "Come up, Billy Parham," she called.
When he entered the parlor, Mr. Sanders stood. He was older, smaller, more frail.
"Get in this house," he said.
"I'm awful dirty to come in."
"You come on in. We thought you'd died."
"No, sir, not yet, I ain't."
The old man shook his hand and held it. He was looking past him toward the door.
"Where's that boy at?" he said.
They ate in the dining room. The girl served them and then sat down. They ate roast beef and potatoes and beans, and the girl passed him a bread dish covered with a linen cloth, and he took a piece of cornbread and buttered it.
"This is awful good," he said. "She's a good cook," the old man said. "I hope she don't decide to get married and quit me. If I had to cook for myself, the cats would leave."
"Oh, Granddaddy," the girl said.
"They wanted to put Miller 4F2, the old man said, "on account of his leg. They took him up at Albuquerque. They run him through up there, I reckon, in wholesale lots."
"They didn't me. Are they going to put him in the cavalry?"
"I don't think so. I don't think they're even going to have one."
He looked out across the table, chewing slowly. In the yellow light of the pressed glass chandelier, the old photographs and portraits above the sideboard seemed like artifacts salvaged from some ancient removal. Even the old man seemed distant from them. From the sepia-tinted buildings, the old shake roofs, the people on horseback, men sitting among cardboard cactus in a photographer's studio in suits and ties, with the legs of their breeches stogged into their boot tops, and rifles standing upright before them. The antique dresses of the women, the wary or haunted cast to their eyes, like people photographed at gunpoint.
"That's John Slaughter in that picture at the end yonder."
"Which one?"
"That last one on the top right under Miller's certificate. That was took in front of his house."
"Who's the Indian girl?"
"That's Apache May. They brought her back from an Indian camp they raided. Bunch of Apaches been stealing cattle. 1895 or 6, somewhere's in there. He may have killed some of them. He come back with her. She was just a little thing. She was wearing a dress made from an election poster, and he took her and raised her as his own. He was just crazy about her. She died in a fire not long after that picture was took.
Did you know him?
I did. I worked for him at one time.
Did you ever kill an Indian?
No, I come near it a time or two. Some that worked for me.
Who is that on the mule?
That's James Autry. He didn't care what he rode.
Who's that with the lion on the pack horse?
The old man shook his head.
I know his name, he said, but I can't say it.
He drained his coffee and rose and got his cigarettes and an ashtray from the sideboard. The ashtray was from the Chicago World's Fair, and it was cast from pot metal, and it said 1833 to 1933. It said a century of progress.
Let's go in here, he said.
They went in the parlor. There was a paneled oak pump organ against the wall where they passed through from the dining room. A lace throw on top of it. A framed hand-tinted portrait of the old man's wife as a young woman.
That thing don't play, the old man said. Ain't nobody to play it no way.
My grandmama used to play one, Billy said, in the church.
Women used to play music. Anymore you just turn on a Victrola.
He bent and opened the stove door with the poker and poked the fire up and put another split log in and shut the door. They sat, and the old man told him stories about raw-hiding cattle in Mexico as a young man and about Villa's raid on Columbus, New Mexico in 1916, and about sheriff's posses tracking bad men down into the boot heel as they fled toward the border, and about the drought and die-up of 86, and trailing north the Corriente cattle that they'd bought for next to nothing up out of that stricken ground across the high-parched plains. Cattle so poor, the old man said that at evening, crossing before the sun where it burned upon the western desert shore, you could all but see through them.
"What do you aim to do?" he said.
"I don't know. Try and hire on somewheres, I reckon.
We're about shut down here altogether."
"Yes, sir, I wasn't asking."
"This war," the old man said. "There's no way to calculate what's to come."
"No, sir, I don't reckon there is."
The old man tried to get him to stay the night, but he would not. They stood on the porch. It was cold, and the prairie all about lay in a deep silence. The horse snickered at them from the gate.
"You'd do just as well to start fresh in the morning," the old man said.
"I know it. I just need to get on."
"Well?"
"I like riding of a night anyways."
"Yes," the old man said. "I always did. You take care, son."
"Yes, sir, I will. Thank you."
He camped that night on the broad Animas plain, and the wind blew in the grass, and he slept on the ground wrapped in the serape and in the wool blanket the old man had given him. He built a small fire, but he had little wood, and the fire died in the night, and he woke and watched the winter stars slip their hold and race to their deaths in the darkness. He could hear the horse step in its hobbles and hear the grass rip softly in the horse's mouth, and hear it breathing or the toss of its tail, and he saw far to the south beyond the Hatchet Mountains the flare of lightning over Mexico, and he knew that he would not be buried in this valley but in some distant place among strangers, and he looked out to where the grass was running in the wind under the cold starlight as if it were the earth itself, hurtling headlong. And he said softly before he slept again that the one thing he knew of all things claimed to be known was that there was no certainty to any of it. Not just the coming of war, anything at all. He went to work for the Hash Knives, except that it wasn't the Hash Knives anymore. They sent him out to a line camp on the Little Colorado. In 3 months, he saw three other human beings. When he got paid in March, he went to the post office in Winslow and sent a money order to Mr. Sanders for the $20 he owed him. And he went to a bar on First Street and sat on a stool and pushed back his hat with his thumb and ordered a beer.
"What kind of beer you want?" the barman said.
"Just any kind, it don't matter."
"You ain't old enough to drink beer."
"Then why did you ask me what kind I wanted?"
"It don't matter, 'cause I ain't serving you."
"What kind is he drinking?"
The man down the bar that he'd nodded to studied him.
"This is a draft, son," he said. "Just tell him you want a draft."
"Yes, sir, thank you."
"Don't mention it."
He walked up the street and went in the next bar and sat on a stool. The barman wandered down and stood before him.
"Give me a draft."
He went back down the bar and pulled the beer into a round glass mug and came back and set it on the bar. Billy put a dollar on the bar, and the barman went to the cash register and rang it up and came back and clapped down 75 cents.
"Where are you from?" he said.
"Down around Cloverdale. I've been working for the Hash Knives."
"There ain't no Hash Knives. Babbitt sold it."
"Yeah, I know it."
"Sold it to a sheep herder."
"Yeah."
"What do you think of that?"
"I don't know."
"Well, I do."
Billy looked down the bar. It was empty, save for a soldier who looked drunk. The soldier was watching him.
"They never sold him the brand, though, did they?" the barman said.
"No."
"No, so there ain't no Hash Knives." "You want a flip for the jukebox?"
the soldier said.
Billy looked at him.
"No," he said, "I wouldn't care to."
"Sit there, then."
"I aim to."
"Is there something wrong with that beer?" the barman said.
"No, I don't reckon. Do you get a lot of complaints?"
"I just noticed you ain't drinking it, is all."
Billy looked at the beer. He looked down the length of the bar. The soldier had turned slightly and was sitting with one hand on his knee, as if he might be deciding whether or not to get up.
"I just thought there might be something wrong with it," the barman said.
"Well, I don't reckon there is," Billy said, "but if there is, I'll let you know."
"You got a cigarette?" the soldier said.
"I don't smoke."
"You don't smoke?"
"No." The barman fished a pack of Lucky Strikes from his shirt pocket and palmed them onto the bar and slid them down to the soldier.
"There you go, soldier," he said.
"Thanks," the soldier said. He shook a cigarette upright in the pack and pulled it free with his mouth and took a lighter from his pocket and lit the cigarette and put the lighter on the bar and slid the pack of cigarettes back to the barman.
"What's that in your pocket?" he said.
"Who are you talking to?" said Billy. The soldier blew smoke down the bar.
"Talking to you," he said.
"Well," said Billy, "I reckon it's my business what I got in my pocket." The soldier didn't answer. He sat smoking. The barman reached and got the cigarettes from the bar and took one and lit it and put the pack back in his shirt pocket. He stood leaning against the back bar with his arms crossed and the smoldering cigarette in his fingers. No one spoke. They seemed to be waiting for someone to arrive.
"Do you know how old I am?" the barman said.
Billy looked at him.
"No," he said. "How would I know how old you are?" "I'll be 38 years old in June. June 14th.
Billy didn't answer.
"That's how come I ain't in uniform."
Billy looked at the soldier. The soldier sat smoking.
"I tried to enlist," the barman said. "Tried to lie about my age, but they wasn't having none of it."
"He don't care," the soldier said. "Uniform don't mean nothing to him." The barman pulled on his cigarette and blew smoke toward the bar.
"I'll bet it'd mean something if it had that rising sun on the collar and they was coming down 2nd Street about 10 abreast. I bet it'd mean something then."
Billy picked up the beer mug and drank it dry and set it back on the bar and stood up and pulled his hat forward and looked a last time at the soldier and turned and went out into the street. He worked another 9 months for Aja, and when he left he had a pack horse that he'd traded for and a regular bedroll and sugan and an old single-shot .32-caliber Stevens rifle. He rode south across the high plains west of Socorro, and he rode through Magdalena and across the plains of St. Augustine. When he rode into Silver City it was snowing, and he checked into the Palace Hotel and sat in the room and watched the snow falling in the street. There was no one about. He went out after a while and walked down Bullard Street to the feed store, but it was closed. He found a grocery store and bought 6 boxes of breakfast cereal and came back and fed them to the horses and put the horses in the yard behind the hotel and got his supper in the hotel dining room and went up and went to bed. When he came down in the morning, he was the only one at breakfast, and when he went out to try and buy some clothes, all the shops were closed. It was gray and cold in the streets, and a mean wind blew out of the north, and there was no one about. He tried the door of the drugstore because there was a light on inside, but it was closed too. When he got back to the hotel, he asked the clerk if today was Sunday, and the clerk said it was Friday. He looked out at the street. "There ain't no stores open," he said.
"It's Christmas Day," the clerk said. Ain't no stores open on Christmas Day.
He drifted into the North Texas Panhandle, and he worked out most of the following year for the Matadors, and he worked for the T-Diamond. He drifted south, and he worked small spreads, some no more than a week. By the spring of the third year of the war, there was hardly a ranch house in all of that country that did not have a gold star in the window. He worked until March on a small ranch out of Magdalena, New Mexico, and then one day he got his pay and saddled his horse and tied his bedroll onto the pack horse and rode south again. He crossed the last blacktop highway just east of Stein's and 2 days later rode up to the SK Bar gate. It was a cool spring day, and the old man was sitting on the porch in his rocker with his hat on and a Bible in his lap. He'd bent forward to see if he could tell who it was, as if the extra foot of proximity might bring the rider into focus. He looked older and more frail, much reduced from his former self in the 2 years since he'd seen him. Billy called his name, and the old man said for him to get down, and he did. When he got to the foot of the steps, he stopped, with one hand on the paint-flaked baluster, and looked up at the old man. The old man sat with the Bible closed over one finger to mark its place.
"Is that you, Parham?" he said.
"Yes, sir, Billy." He walked up the steps and took off his hat and shook hands with the old man. The old man's eyes had faded to a paler blue. He held Billy's hand a long time.
"Bless your heart," he said. "I've thought about you 1,000 times. Sit down here where we can visit."
He pulled up one of the old cane-bottomed chairs and sat and put his hat over his knee and looked out over the pasture lands toward the mountains, and he looked at the old man.
"I reckon you knew about Miller," the old man said.
"No, sir, I've not had much news.
He was killed on Kwajalein Atoll."
"I'm awful sorry to hear that."
"We've had it pretty rough here. Pretty rough."
They sat. There was a breeze coming up the country. A pot of asparagus fern hanging from the porch eaves at the corner swung gently, and its shadow oscillated over the boards of the porch, slow and random and uncentered.
"Are you doing all right?" Billy said. "Oh, I'm all right. I had an operation for cataracts back in the fall, but I'm making it. Leona went off and got married on me. Now her husband's shipped out, and she's living in Roswell, I don't know what for. Got a job. I tried to reason with her, but you know how that goes."
"Yes, sir."
"By rights, I got no business being here at all."
"I hope you live forever."
"Don't wish that on me."
He'd leaned back and closed the Bible shut.
"That rain is coming this way," he said.
"Yes, sir, I believe it is."
"Can you smell it?"
"Yes, sir."
"I always loved that smell."
They sat. After a while, Billy said, "Can you smell it?"
"No."
They sat.
"What do you hear from that Boyd?" the old man said.
"I ain't heard nothing. He never come back from Mexico, or if he did, I never heard it." The old man didn't speak for a long time. He watched the darkening country to the south.
"I seen it rain on a blacktop road in Arizona one time," he said. "It rained on one side of the white line for a good 1/2 mile and the other side bone dry, right down the center line."
"I can believe that," Billy said. "I've seen it rain that away."
"It was a peculiar thing to see."
"I seen it thunder in a snowstorm one time," Billy said. "Thunder and lightning. You couldn't see the lightning. Just everything would light up all around you, white as cotton."
"I had a Mexican one time to tell me that," the old man said. "I didn't know whether to believe him or not."
"It was in Mexico was where I seen it."
"Maybe they don't have it in this country."
Billy smiled. He crossed his boots on the boards of the porch in front of him and watched the country.
"I like them boots," the old man said. "I bought 'em in Albuquerque. They look to be good uns.
I hope they are. I'd give enough for 'em."
"Everything's higher than a cat's back with the war and all. What all you can even find to buy."
Doves were coming in and crossing the pasture toward the stock pond west of the house.
"You ain't got married on us, have you?" the old man said.
"No, sir."
"People hate to see a man single. I don't know what there is about it. They used to pester me about getting married again, and I was near 60 when my wife died. My sister-in-law primarily.
I done already had the best woman ever was. Ain't nobody gonna be that lucky twice running.
No, sir, most likely not.
I remember old Uncle Bud Langford used to tell people, said, it would take one hell of a wife to beat no wife at all. Of course, then he was never married neither, so I don't know how he would know.
I guess I've got to say that I don't understand the first thing about him.
What's that?
Women.
Well, said the old man, at least he ain't took to lying.
There wouldn't be no use in it.
Why don't you put your horses up before your plunder gets wet out yonder?
I reckon I'd best be getting on.
You ain't gonna ride off in the rain. We're fixing to eat supper here in just a few minutes. I got a Mexican woman cooks for me.
Well, I probably need to move while the spirit's on me.
Just stay and take supper.
Hell, you just got here. When he came back from the barn, the wind was blowing harder, but it still had not begun to rain.
I remember that horse, the old man said. That was your daddy's horse.
Yes, sir.
He bought it off a Mexican. He claimed the horse when he bought it didn't know a word of English.
The old man pushed himself up from his rocker and clutched the Bible under his arm.
Even getting up out of a chair gets to be work. You wouldn't believe that, would you?
Do you think horses understand what people say?
I ain't sure most people do. Let's go in. She's done hollered twice.
He was up in the morning before daybreak, and he went through the dark house to the kitchen, where there was a light. The woman was sitting at the kitchen table listening to an old wooden radio shaped like a bishop's hat. She was listening to a station out of Ciudad Juarez, and when he stood in the door, she turned it off and looked at him. Está bien, he said. No tiene que apagarlo. She shrugged and rose. She said that it was over anyway. She asked him if he would like his breakfast, and he said that he would. While she was fixing it, he walked out to the barn and brushed the horses and cleaned their hooves, and then saddled Nino and left the latigo loose, and he strapped the old Visalia pack frame onto his bed horse, and tied on his sugan and went back to the house. She got his breakfast out of the oven and set it on the table. She'd cooked eggs and ham and flour tortillas and beans, and she set it in front of him and poured his coffee.
¿Quiere crema? She said.
No, gracias.
¿Hay salsa?
She set the salsa at his elbow in a small lava stone mocajete.
Gracias.
He thought that she would leave, but she didn't. She stood watching him eat.
¿Es pariente del señor Sanders? She said.
No, él era amigo de mi padre. He looked up at her.
Siéntate, he said.
Puede sentarse. She made a little motion with her hand. He didn't know what it meant. She stood as before.
Su salud no es buena, he said.
She said that it was not. She said that he had had trouble with his eyes and that he was very sad over his nephew who was killed in the war.
¿Conoció a su sobrino? She said.
Sí, ¿y usted? She said that she had not known the nephew. She said that when she came to work here, the nephew was already dead. She said that she had seen his picture and that he was very handsome. He ate the last of the eggs and wiped the plate with the tortilla, and ate the tortilla, and drank the last of the coffee, and wiped his mouth, and looked up and thanked her.
¿Tiene que hacer un viaje largo? She said.
He rose and put the napkin on the table and took his hat up from the other chair and put it on. He said that he did indeed have a long journey. He said he did not know what the end of his journey would look like or whether he would know it when he got there, and he asked her in Spanish to pray for him, but she said she had already decided to do so before he even asked. He signed the horses through the Mexican customs at Berendo and folded the stamped entry papers into his saddlebag and gave the aduanero a silver dollar. The aduanero saluted him gravely and addressed him as Caballero, and he rode south into Old Mexico, state of Chihuahua. He'd last passed through this port of entry 7 years ago when he was 13, and his father rode the horse he now rode, and they had taken delivery of 800 head of cattle from 2 Americans raw-hiding the back acres of an abandoned ranch in the mountains to the west of Ascension. At that time there had been a cafe here, but now there was none. He rode down the little mud street and bought 3 tacos from a woman sitting beside a charcoal brazier in the dust of the roadside and ate them as he went. 2 days' riding brought him at evening to the town of Janos, or to the lights thereof sighted on the darkening plain below him. He sat the horse in the old rutted wagon road and looked off toward the western Sierras, black against the blood-red drop of the sky. Beyond lay the Bavispe River country, and the high Pilaris with the snow still clinging in the northern Rincones, and the nights still cold up there on the Alto Plano, where he had ridden another horse in another time long ago. He approached from the east in the dark, riding past one of the crumbling mud towers of the ancient walled town, and riding slowly through a settlement composed wholly of mud and in ruins 100 years. He rode past the tall mud church and past the old green Spanish bells hung from their trestle pole in the yard, and past the open doors of the houses where men sat smoking quietly. Behind them in the yellow light of the oil lamps the women moved at their tasks. Over the town hung a haze of charcoal smoke, and from somewhere in those dusky warrens music was playing. He followed the sound down the narrow mud corridors and hove up at last before a door nailed up out of raw pine boards, crusted with dried rosin and hung on bullhide hinges. The room he entered was but one more in the row of cribs inhabited or abandoned that lined either side of the little street. When he entered, the music ceased, and the musicians turned and looked at him. There were several tables in the room, and all had ornately turned legs that were stained with mud as if they'd stood outside in the rain. At one of the tables sat four men with glasses and a bottle. Along the back wall was an ornate Brunswick bar brought here from God knew where, and on the shelves of the carved and dusty back bar there were half a dozen bottles, some with labels, some without. "Está abierto?" he said. One of the men pushed back his chair on the clay floor and stood. He was very tall, and when he stood his head vanished into the darkness above the single shaded bulb that hung over the table. "Sí, caballero," he said. "Cómo no?" He went to the bar and took down an apron from a nail and tied it about his waist and stood before the dimly lit carved mahogany with his hands crossed before him. He looked like a butcher standing in a church. Billy nodded at the other three men at the table and wished them a good evening, but none spoke back. The musicians rose with their instruments and filed out into the street. He pushed his hat back slightly on his head and crossed the room and put his hands on the bar and studied the bottles on the back wall. "Deme un waterfilsy Fraser," he said. The barman held up one finger, as if agreeing with the wisdom of his choice. He reached and took down a tumbler from among a varied collection and righted it on the bar and reached down the whiskey and poured the glass half full. "Agua," he said. "No gracias. Tome algo para usted." The barman thanked him and reached down another tumbler and poured it and set the bottle on the bar. On the dust of the bottle his hand had left an imprint visible in the sallow glare from the lamp. Billy held up his glass and looked at the barman across the rim of it. "Salud," he said. "Salud," said the barman. They drank. Billy set his glass down and gestured at it with a circling motion of his finger that included the barman's glass also. He turned and looked at the three men sitting on the table. "Y sus amigos también," he said. "Bueno," said the barman. "Cómo no?" He crossed the room in his apron with the bottle and poured their glasses, and they toasted his health, and he raised his own glass, and they drank. The barman returned to the bar where he stood uncertainly, glass and bottle in hand. Billy set his glass on the bar. Finally, a voice from the table spoke to ask that he join them. He picked up the glass and turned and thanked them. He did not know who had spoken. When he pulled back the chair which the barman had earlier vacated and sat in it, and looked up, he could see that the oldest of the three men was very drunk. He wore a sweat-stained guayabera, and he slouched in his chair with his chin resting in the open collar of it. The black eyes in their red-rimmed cups were sullen and depthless, like lead slag poured into borings to seal away something virulent or predaceous. In the slow shuttering of the lids, an overlong interval. It was the younger man on his right who spoke. He said that it was a long distance between drinks of whiskey for a traveler in this country. Billy nodded. He looked at the bottle standing on their table. It was slightly yellow, slightly misshapen. There was no stopper to it nor label, and it held a thin lease of fluid, a thin sediment, a thinly curved agave worm. "Tomamos mezcal," the man said.
He leaned back in his chair and called to the barman. "Venga," he called. "Siéntate con nosotros." The barman set the whiskey bottle on the bar, but Billy said for him to bring it. He untied his apron and took it off and hung it back on the nail and came over with the bottle. Billy waved at the glasses on the table. "Otra vez," he said. "Otra vez," said the barman. He poured the glasses round. When he had filled all save the glass of the man who was drunk, he hesitated, for the prior pouring yet stood before him. The younger man touched his elbow. "Alfonso," he said, "tome." Alfonso drank not. He stared leadenly at the pale newcomer. He seemed not so much reduced by drink as restored to some atavistic state once lost to him. The younger man looked across the table at the American. "Es un hombre muy serio," he said. The barman stood the bottle before them and dragged a chair across from a nearby table and sat. All raised their glasses. They would have drunk except that Alfonso chose that moment to speak. "¿Quién es, joven?" he said. They paused. They looked at Billy. Billy lifted his glass and drank and sat the empty glass down and looked across the table at those eyes again. "Un hombre," he said, "no más."
"Americano."
"Claro, americano."
"Es vaquero?"
"Sí, vaquero." The drunk man did not move. His eyes did not move. He could have been speaking to himself. "Tome, Alfonso," said the younger man. He raised his own glass and looked around the table. The others raised their glasses. All drank. "¿Y usted?" said Billy. The drunk man did not answer. His wet red underlip hung loosely away from the perfect white teeth. He seemed not to have heard.
"¿Es soldado?" he said.
"Soldado, no." The younger man said that the drunk man had been a soldier in the Revolution, and that he had fought at Torreon and at Zacatecas, and that he had been wounded many times. Billy looked at the drunk man, the opaque black of his eyes. The younger man said that he had received 3 bullets in the chest at Zacatecas, and lain in the dirt of the streets in darkness and cold while the dogs drank his blood. He said that the holes were there in the patriot's chest for all to see. "Otra vez," said Billy. The barman leaned forward with the bottle and poured. When all the glasses were filled, the younger man raised his glass and offered a toast to the Revolution. They drank. They set their glasses down and wiped their mouths with the backs of their hands and looked at the drunk man.
"¿Por qué viene aquí?" the drunk man said.
They looked at Billy.
"Aquí?" said Billy.
But the drunk man did not respond to questions. He only asked them. The younger man leaned slightly forward.
"A este país," he whispered.
"A este país," said Billy. They waited. He leaned forward and reached across the table and took the drunk man's glass of mezcal and slung its contents out across the room and set the glass back on the table. No one moved. He gestured to the barman. "Otra vez," he said. The barman reached slowly for the bottle and slowly poured the glasses once again. He set the bottle down and wiped his hand on the knee of his trousers. Billy picked up his glass and held it before him. He said that he was in their country to find his brother. He said that his brother was a little crazy and he should not have abandoned him, but he did. They sat holding their glasses. They looked at the drunk man. "Tome, Alfonso," said the younger man. He gestured with his glass. The barman raised his own glass and drank and set the empty glass on the table again and leaned back. Like a player who has moved his piece and sits back to await the results. He looked across the table at the youngest man who sat slightly apart with his hat down over his forehead and his full glass in both hands before him like an offering, who'd so far said no word at all. The whole room had begun to hum very slightly. The ends of all ceremony are but to avert bloodshed. But the drunk man by his condition inhabited a twilight state of responsibility, and to this the man at his side made silent appeal. He smiled and shrugged and raised his glass to the Norte Americano and drank. When he set his glass down again, the drunk man stirred. He leaned slowly forward and reached for his glass, and the younger man smiled and raised his glass again as if to welcome him back from his morbidities. But the drunk man clutched the glass and then slowly held it out to the side of the table and poured the whiskey on the floor and set the glass back upon the table once more. Then he reached unsteadily for the bottle of mezcal and turned it up and poured the oily yellow fuel into his glass and set the bottle back on the table with the sediment and the worm coiling slowly clockwise in the glass floor of it. Then he leaned back as before. The younger man looked at Billy. Outside in the darkened town, a dog barked. "No le gusta el whisky?" Billy said. The drunk man did not answer. The glass of mezcal sat as it had sat when Billy first entered the bar. "Es el sello," said the younger man.
"El sello?"
"Sí." He said that he objected to the seal, which was the seal of an oppressive government. He said that he would not drink from such a bottle, that it was a matter of honor. Billy looked at the drunk man.
"Es mentira," the drunk man said.
"Mentira?" said Billy.
"Sí, mentira."
Billy looked at the younger man. He asked him what it was that was a lie, but the younger man told him not to preoccupy himself.
"Nada es mentira," he said.
"No es cuestión de ningún sello," the drunk man said.
He spoke slowly, but not without facility. He had turned and addressed his statement to the younger man beside him. Then he turned back and continued to stare at Billy. Billy made a circle with his finger.
"Otra vez," he said.
The barman reached and took up the bottle.
"You want to drink that stinking cat piss in favor of good American whiskey," Billy said. "You be my guest."
"Mande," said the drunk man.
The barman sat uncertainly. Then he leaned and poured the empty glasses and picked up the cork and pushed it back into the bottle. Billy raised his glass.
"Salud," he said.
He drank. All drank, save for the drunk man. Out in the street, the old Spanish bells rang once, rang twice. The drunk leaned forward. He reached past the glass of mezcal standing before him and seized the bottle of mezcal again. He picked it up and poured Billy's glass full with a slight circular movement of his hand, as if the small tumbler must be filled in some prescribed fashion. Then he tipped the bottle up and set it on the table and leaned back. The barman and the two younger men sat holding their glasses. Billy sat looking at the mezcal. He leaned back in the chair. He looked toward the door. He could see Nino standing in the street. The musicians who had fled were already playing again somewhere in another street, another taverna, or perhaps it was other musicians. He reached and took up the mezcal and held it to the light. A smoke-like sediment curled in the glass, small bits of debris. No one moved. He tilted the glass and drank.
"Salud," called the younger man.
They drank. The barman drank. They clapped their empty tumblers on the table and they smiled around. Then Billy leaned to one side and spat the mezcal on the floor. In the ensuing silence, the pueblo itself seemed to have been sucked up by the desert round. There was no sound anywhere. The drunk man sat stilled in the act of reaching for his glass. The younger man lowered his eyes. In the shadow of the lamp, his eyes even looked closed, and may have been. The drunk man balled his reaching hand and lowered it to the table. Billy circled one finger in the air slowly.
"Otra vez," he said.
The barman looked at Billy. He looked at the leaden-eyed patriot sitting with his fist upright beside his glass.
"Era demasiado fuerte para él," he said. "Demasiado fuerte."
Billy didn't take his eyes from the drunk man.
"Mas mentiras," he said.
He said that it was not at all the case that the mezcal was too strong for him, as the barman claimed. They sat looking at the mezcal bottle, at the black half-moon of the bottle's shadow beside the bottle. When the drunk man did not move or speak, Billy reached across the table for the whiskey bottle and poured the glasses round once more and set the bottle back on the table. Then he pushed back his chair and stood. The drunk man placed both hands on the edge of the table. The man who had not so far spoken at all said in English that if he reached for his billfold, the man would shoot him.
"I don't doubt that for a minute," Billy said.
He spoke to the bartender without taking his eyes from the man across the table.
"Cuánto debo?" he said.
$5, said the barman.
He reached into his shirt pocket with two fingers and took out his money and dealt it open with his thumb and slid loose a $5 bill and laid it on the table. He looked at the man who'd spoken to him in English.
"Will he shoot me in the back?" he said.
The man looked up at him from under his hat brim and smiled.
"No," he said, "I don't think so.
Billy touched the brim of his hat and nodded to the men at the table. Caballeros, he said, and turned to start for the door, leaving his filled glass on the table.
If he calls to you, do not turn around, the young man said.
He did not stop, and he did not turn, and he'd very nearly reached the door when the man did call.
Joven, he said.
He stopped. The horses out in the street raised their heads and looked at him. He looked at the distance to the door, which was no more than his own length.
Walk, he said, just walk.
But he didn't walk. He turned around. The drunk man had not moved. He sat in his chair, and the young man who spoke English had risen and stood beside him with one hand on his shoulder. They looked to be posed for some album of outlawry.
Me llama embustero, said the drunk man.
No, he said.
Embustero?
He clawed at his shirt and ripped it open. It was fastened with snaps, and it opened easily and with no sound, as if perhaps the snaps were worn and loose from just such demonstrations in the past. He sat holding his shirt wide open as if to invite again the trinity of rifle balls whose imprint lay upon his smooth and hairless chest, just over his heart, in so perfect an isosceles stigmata. No one at the table moved. None looked at the patriot nor at his scars, for they had seen it all before. They watched the guero where he stood framed in the door. They did not move, and there was no sound, and he listened for something in the town that would tell him that it was not also listening, for he had a sense that some part of his arrival in this place was not only known but ordained. And he listened for the musicians who had fled upon his even entering these premises, and who themselves perhaps were listening to the silence from somewhere in those cratered mud precincts. And he listened for any sound at all other than the dull thud of his heart, dragging the blood through the small dark corridors of his corporeal life in its slow hydraulic tolling. He looked at the man who'd warned him not to turn, but that was all the warning that man had. What he saw was that the only manifest artifact of the history of this negligible republic where he now seemed about to die that had the least authority or meaning or claim to substance was seated here before him in the sallow light of this cantina, and all else from men's lips or from men's pens would require that it be beat out hot all over again upon the anvil of its own enactment before it could even qualify as a lie. Then it all passed. He took off his hat and stood. Then, for better or for worse, he put it on again, and turned, and walked out the door, and untied the horses, and mounted up, and rode out down the narrow street, leading the pack horse, and he did not look back. He'd not got clear of the town before a drop of rain the size of a middle taw landed in the brim of his hat. Then another. He looked up into a cloudless sky, the visible planets burning in the east. There was no wind nor smell of rain in the air, yet the drops fell the more. The horse wanted to stop in the road, and the rider looked back at the dark town, the few small window squares of dim and reddish light. The smack of the rain falling on the hard clay of the road sounded like horses somewhere in the darkness crossing a bridge. He was beginning to feel drunk. He halted the horse and then turned and rode back. He rode the horse through the first door he came to, dropping the pack horse's rope and leaning low along his horse's neck to clear the door beam. Inside, he sat the animal in the selfsame rein, and he looked up to see the selfsame stars above him. He reined the horse about and rode out again and entered another doorway, and at once the muted clatter of the raindrops on the crown of his hat ceased. He got down and stomped about in the dark to see what was underfoot. He went out and brought in the pack horse and untied the diamond hitch and pulled his sugan off onto the ground and unbuckled and pulled down the pack frame and hobbled the animal and drove it back out into the rain. Then he pulled loose the latigo on his saddle horse and pulled off the saddle and saddlebags and stood the saddle against the wall and knelt down and felt out the ropes on the sugan and untied and unrolled it and sat and pulled off his boots. He was feeling drunker. He took off his hat and lay down. The horse walked past his head and stood looking out the door.
"Don't you step on me, damn you," he said.
When he woke in the morning, the rain had stopped, and it was full daylight. He felt awful. He'd risen sometime in the night and staggered out to vomit, and he remembered casting about with his weeping eyes for some sign of the horses and then staggering in again. He might not have remembered it except that when he sat up and looked around for his boots, they were on his feet.
He picked up his hat and put it on and looked toward the door. Several children who had been crouched there, watching him, stood up and backed away.
¿Dónde están los caballos? He said.
They said that the horses were eating. He stood too fast and leaned against the door jamb, holding his eyes. He was afire with thirst. He raised his head again and stepped out through the door and looked at the children. They were pointing down the road. He walked out past the last of the row of low mud dwellings with the children following behind, and walked the horses down in a grassy field on the south side of the town where a small stream crossed the road. He stood holding Nino's reins. The children watched.
¿Quieres montar? He said.
They looked at one another. The youngest was a boy of about 5, and he held both arms straight up in the air and stood waiting. Billy picked him up and set him astride the horse, and then the little girl, and lastly the oldest boy. He told the oldest boy to hold on to the younger ones, and the boy nodded, and he picked up the reins again and the pack horse's trailing rope, and led both horses back up toward the road. A woman was coming along from the town. When the children saw her, they whispered among themselves. She was carrying a blue pail with a cloth over it. She stood by the side of the road, holding the pail by the bale wire in both hands before her. Then she started down through the field towards them. Billy touched his hat and wished her a good morning. She stopped and stood holding the pail. She said that she had been looking for him. She said that she knew he'd not gone far because his bed and his saddle were where he'd left them. She said that the children had told her that there was a horseman asleep in the caídas at the edge of town who was sick, and she had brought him some menudo hot from the fire, and if he would eat it, he would then have strength for his journey. She bent and set the pail on the ground and lifted away the cloth and handed the cloth to him. He stood holding it and looking down at the pail. Inside sat a bowl of speckled tinware covered with a saucer, and beside the bowl were wedged some folded tortillas. He looked at her. Andale, she said. She gestured toward the pail. ¿Y usted?
Ya comí.
He looked at the children aligned upon the horse's back. He handed up the reins and the catch rope to the boy. Toma un paseo, he said.